Welcome to the Burn Bag Podcast. My name is Andre Gonoella. I'm being joined by my co-host Ryan Rosenthal, and we have a great discussion today on nuclear policy, nuclear issues, and the circumstances around nuclear weapons with Dr. Kennedy Benedict, who is a senior advisor to the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists and a current lecturer at the Harris School of Public Policy at the University of Chicago. Between 2005 and 2015, she was the executive director and the publisher of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, which is a leading scholarly magazine about the threats to humanity from nuclear weapons, climate change, and emerging technologies. She has published many, many articles, has done many, many interviews about nuclear weapons and disarmament. And before that, actually, between 1991 and 2005, Dr. Benedict was the director of the International Peace and Security at the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, which oversaw grant making on a broad international security agenda. Dr. Benedict currently teaches a great class on nuclear policy at the Harris School. I was privileged to have taken it this past year, and we're looking very much forward to this conversation on nuclear weapons. Thank you, Dr. Benedict, for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you once again, Dr. Benedict. I'm very much looking forward to this conversation. I did not have the privilege of taking a course with you, so maybe today will be a mini course for me. And so let's begin with the origins of the atomic bomb. We can look back to 1945, the dropping of the atomic bomb over Hiroshima and Nagasaki by the United States at the end of World War II. Proponents of the bomb's usage asserted that the bomb was necessary because a land invasion of Japan would result in mass U.S. casualties and would unnecessarily prolong the war. But were there other reasons, and did the U.S. understand the scale of the geopolitical circumstances of the bomb? And maybe the question is, did they see a Cold War coming?
Yeah, you're right. They did. And in fact, even when Roosevelt was president, he understood that the Soviets, while they were an ally during World War II, also could pose a threat to the United States after the end of World War II. Joseph Stalin was not seen as a great peacemaker, really, and so they understood that the bomb could be used if it came to a standoff between the two countries. And then in the Truman administration, the same thing. Many people understood that this would be something that could be used against the Soviets. And in fact, while some in the scientific establishment thought it would be a good idea to share the information about the atomic bomb with the Soviets, because they were allies after all, they were prevented from doing that because they really felt it should be something that was only for the United States and could be a real, really important for the United States in its future relations with the Soviet Union. So, yeah, and there still are many people, though, who believe that, in fact, the bomb was used, just as you said, to prevent a land invasion in Japan. But I think there's some historical evidence now that we understand that because the Soviets were about to invade Japan, and in fact, the Japanese were talking about surrendering to the Soviet Union. They would rather surrender to the United States. But there was an instant where the U.S. understood that it was important to get the war over and to demonstrate to the Soviets that they had this phenomenal weapon.
So when we look at the atomic bomb and the advent of this nuclear age, the bomb dramatically changed warfighting strategy for both the United States and the Soviet Union. But how exactly did this strategy change? Like, under what circumstances did nuclear weapons actually figure into military strategy in the Cold War? And does it still feature as actively right now in current military strategy?
Yeah, that's a great question. The way that nuclear weapons changed the calculus was that there is no defense against nuclear weapons. Previously, the defense always had the edge because it was always more expensive to try and overcome the defenses of a country. And so it was deterrence was relatively simple. You just built up a huge defense. Nuclear weapons are so terrible, and one bomb getting through defenses causes so much damage that there really is no defense against nuclear weapons. So the traditional way of understanding deterrence and deterring conventional warfare just, you know, went out the window. So the problem was how to use these nuclear weapons. And in fact, the Air Force created the RAND Corporation in the early 1950s to try and figure out what to do with this new weapon. The scientists had created it out of fear that Nazi Germany would get it first. But once they had it, they weren't quite sure what to do with it. So they brought together game theoretic scientists, Thomas Schelling, John von Neumann, to try and figure out how on earth you could use this very powerful weapon. And they came up with the idea of nuclear deterrence, which was essentially based on the idea that since you couldn't defend against a nuclear attack, what you needed to do was have enough nuclear weapons left over so that you could have a second strike. You could retaliate. And that capability for retaliation was what would prevent a country from first using nuclear weapons. So it was all about getting back at somebody who came at you with nuclear weapons. So as you suggest, that did change military strategy. It also changed the way we thought about weapons. And it led to an extraordinary arms race between the Soviet Union and the United States. You always needed to have just a few more weapons to ensure that you had a second strike capability against the enemy who was going to send nuclear weapons over first. So if you built more nuclear weapons for the second strike capability, the other country needed to build even more to overcome your second strike capability. And you can see this dynamic led to an ever-increasing number of nuclear weapons and the arms race of the Cold War.
Well, we're certainly going to get into the importance of deterrence and second strike capabilities, but kind of before we do so, I mean, actually dropping the bomb, the decision by President Truman was a monumental one. It's a very difficult one. And so I'm curious, historically, were there ever any instances in which world leaders actively thought about deploying the bomb in war when we're looking at, after the first use of the bomb, any subsequent any attempts or thought processes in which that was likely to happen?
In fact, when we look back at the historical record, nearly every single U.S. president has considered using nuclear weapons. This, I think, comes as a surprise to many people because we haven't really heard that much about it. It wasn't always public. But through intermediaries, through secretaries of state, through various measures, every president, starting with President Truman after the first dropping of the atomic bomb, has threatened use of nuclear weapons. So Truman threatened to use them against the Chinese in the Korean War to prevent them from taking the side of North Korea. And Eisenhower did the same. Eisenhower even considered using them to help the French in Vietnam as they were facing North Vietnamese soldiers there. Through Nixon also considered using them in the Vietnam War. Carter considered using them in the Middle East. It goes on and on. Every single president, I think, except perhaps Obama, has considered or threatened using nuclear weapons, usually against the Chinese or against the Soviets. The Soviets, when they invaded Afghanistan, the U.S. was worried that they might invade Iran, which was then an ally. So Carter was threatening to use nuclear weapons against them. So we have been actively, the United States has actively been threatening to use nuclear weapons since the very beginning. So it's not a question of the kind of just deterrence. I mean, if you think of against the Soviets, it's deterrence in many situations using both strategic nuclear weapons, but many times tactical, relatively small nuclear weapons in a region of the world.
So while we want to dig in more into this issue of, like, you know, nuclear strategy and nuclear weapons being used in the contemporary sort of sphere, I sort of want to dig into what exactly nuclear weapons are. I want to break down nuclear weapons with you, Dr. Benedict, because most people have no idea for why these weapons are so dangerous and how the technology actually works. Could you help us understand what exactly a nuclear weapon is?
First of all, it's the most dangerous technology on Earth. That's the first thing that we have to understand. The way it works is based on splitting atoms. And this atoms were first controlled in a controlled experiment. Were split actually at the University of Chicago by Enrico Fermi in the pile in 1942. And that was a controlled, self-sustaining chain reaction of atomic particles. That was hopefully meant by many scientists there to be the start of a civilian nuclear energy program. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we had this abundant energy that we could control and use in many different ways, but mostly for electricity? The bomb came first, though, and the first bomb dropped on Hiroshima was actually a gun-type bomb. They just smashed two chunks of enriched uranium together, and that caused an enormous explosion. Modern day nuclear weapons are based on a slightly more elaborate arrangement, where both fission and fusion are used. There's a chemical explosion, chemical reaction, which ignites a reaction, a fission reaction, which then causes tremendous power and X-rays that then cause a fusion reaction in a thermonuclear bomb. This all happens in billions of seconds, but the explosion of most bombs today in the U.S. arsenal, most of them are around 300 kiloton yield. The Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs were 15. Hiroshima was a 15 kiloton, and Nagasaki at 20 kilotons. So you can see 300 kilotons is a lot more power. And most of the all the weapons really are what we call nuclear weapons. This kind of two-stage process, and so it's a it's extraordinary amount of power. One U.S. nuclear weapon of about 300 kilotons equals all of the explosive power of all of the weapons in World War II, including Nagasaki and Hiroshima bombs. So it's just an extraordinary amount of destructive power.
I mean, you're certainly painting a picture about just how dangerous these weapons are. And so I guess the natural question is, how easy is it to build such a weapon? And what, we talked about the technologies, fission and fusion, but I guess maybe, we talk about the acquisition of these weapons by terrorist organizations or non-state actors. Is that a real threat? Are they easy enough to build or maybe acquire that should be a concern?
Well, there are a couple of different ways to think about it. There was concern, especially at the end of the Cold War, when the Soviet Union fell apart, and many of the places where they stored nuclear weapons were not very well guarded. The Soviet Union was well guarded, the borders around the Soviet Union, but the facilities themselves were not. And when the U.S. Officials went to look, they were appalled to find these weapons stored in facilities which had just a padlock on them, easily entered. And they were also worried that Soviet scientists, because they were not being paid, might be willing to work for a terrorist organization or some other North Korea or Iran to help them build their own nuclear programs. So there was a lot of attention to securing the nuclear weapons and fear that these bombs could be stolen. Stealing a bomb would be a lot easier than making one. We managed to secure those nuclear weapons. But then there came to be much more concern about material that might get into the hands of terrorist organizations, enriched uranium or plutonium that might find its way from even a civilian nuclear program. that could be used to build a nuclear explosion. But most of the time, most experts were really worried about what might be called a dirty bomb. That is, a bomb that would be brought in, you know, in a truck or a suitcase, not one that would come on the top of a ballistic missile, but could be brought into the middle of Manhattan and just detonated there, because this would be a suicide mission. It was thought that since the Al-Qaeda and others were not strangers to suicide missions, that this would be a plausible scenario. And in the 1990s, there were incidents where Interpol, the international police force, did in fact pick up people who were trying to sell enriched uranium, small quantities of enriched uranium and plutonium. And so there was concern that enough of this could be amassed and that subnational groups might get a hold of enough to make a dirty bomb. There was some truth to that. I think that people were necessarily concerned, but we haven't really seen that happen. The biggest, obviously, the most the most plausible other way of these weapons getting around is if a government, a state, decides that it wants to have a nuclear weapons capability. And there, this information is well known to scientists all over the world, nuclear engineers, so that, you know, North Korea was able to develop a nuclear weapons capability. Many countries have that capability. South Africa had a nuclear weapons program. Libya had a nuclear weapons program. These were countries that eventually gave them up, but with the help of international players and international community. But yes, it's possible for any country to develop a nuclear weapons program. And so that's why we're all pretty interested in non-proliferation, preventing the proliferation of weapons, and even talking about disarmament.
So with regards to non-proliferation and disarmament, I mean, like from the U.S. government stance, it's certainly within their security interest to not want a country like Iran or North Korea to obtain a nuclear weapon. But diplomatically, is it like hypocritical from the U.S. government standpoint to sort of, ask like those countries not to develop nuclear weapons since the U.S. will still have these nuclear weapons themselves?
Yeah, I think many people are disappointed by that hypocrisy. In fact, in 1968, when the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty was signed, which the Soviet Union and the United States worked together to put in place, called for not only countries to forego nuclear weapons all over the world, but it also called for the nuclear weapons possessing states at the time to eventually disarm, to get rid of their nuclear weapons when the conditions were right, as it was said in the treaty. And many thought that at the end of the Cold War, conditions were right. Here we were. The Soviet Union was gone. There was no presumed threat of an attack by the Soviet Union on the United States. So it seemed like that would be a perfect time to talk about really drastically reducing, and even getting rid of nuclear weapons altogether. That didn't happen. Many nuclear weapons were dismantled. Certainly the numbers of weapons went from something like 64,000 down to now today about 1,500, which is a huge, 15,000, which is a huge reduction. But the fact is the United States and Russia and France and the United Kingdom and India and Pakistan and Israel and now North Korea all continue to have nuclear weapons. So, yes, I think there is some disappointment. I remember being in India in the mid-1990s and listening to some of the political people in the Indian National Security Council, and they were really quite demonstrably upset. You're right, that here they had admonished by the United States for developing nuclear weapons, and yet when a time came, when the time was ripe, the United States decided to keep the nuclear weapons and still continued to tell others that they shouldn't have any. So yeah, there's, I think, some bitterness even on the part of some who felt that they were hoodwinked, essentially, by the NPT.
Well, thank you for that, Professor. And so I next want to move into capabilities, nuclear capabilities and policy. And so I think most people might be familiar with the concept of the triad, but what does the U.S. nuclear arsenal actually look like, and how would you actually compare it to that of our allies and our adversaries?
The U.S. now has about 1,800 nuclear weapons deployed on, as you say, this triad. It's a three-legged stool of intercontinental ballistic missiles. We have about 400 of those with nuclear weapons on them, about 240 submarines weapons that can be launched from submarines, and about 100 for our bombers. So we have these three methods, delivery vehicles to deliver these weapons to a target. Altogether, we have about 3,570 warheads in total. Some are retired and reserve. So altogether, more than 5,550 nuclear weapons. The Russians have about the same, a little bit less, and a similar kind of triad, although their submarines, they have fewer submarines and less capability, but their ICBMs are fully capable and can reach us in 30 minutes. So this is really the two big ones. They continue to be the two largest. Next in line, we have France with 300 nuclear weapons, the United Kingdom with about 150 or so. India and Pakistan each have 150 or so. I'm sorry, I missed China, which has about 300, we estimate, maybe a little bit more. Israel has about, depending on who you talk to, anywhere from 80 to 150, as many as 150. And North Korea has, we're not sure, essentially. They've tested a few. They may have 5 or 6, and they have more plutonium that they could use to make more nuclear weapons. So you can see in this kind of chart, that the U.S. and Russia still have the vast majority of nuclear weapons. And I think what I think is probably the most significant, at least from my point of view, is that the U.S. and Russia have these weapons on a very high launch status. In other words, our weapons can be launched in a matter of 12 or 15 minutes. If the president decides to activate launch codes, those weapons will fly out and be at their targets in 30 minutes. The same goes for the Russians. Their weapons can be launched and can hit targets, mostly in the United States, in 30 minutes. And there's no recalling the ICBMs. That's the difference between a submarine and an airplane, obviously. Once they're launched, there's no way to bring them back. So I think that's, and that was presumably useful in some ways during the Cold War when we were looking to show that we had a major deterrent against the Soviets using weapons against us. But at this point, having such a high state of launch readiness can be the source of accidents and also of blunders, blundering into a nuclear exchange, which would really spell doom.
So you mentioned China in that statement, and I mean, many people are sort of saying, seeing that the U.S.-China relationship or the adversarial relationship might define what some have termed a new Cold War. Others do not believe it's a Cold War, but regardless, I mean, I think China is our greatest geopolitical threat, at least for the U.S. And China has been taking some steps to modernize their own nuclear arsenal. Is this a threat? If it is a threat, should we be taking it more seriously? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, my thought about China is that the threat to the United States comes less from their nuclear arsenal than it does from their economic competitiveness and the ideological struggle that we may be in with them about what system of government is really the best, whether a one-party authoritarian government is better, more efficient for its citizens, or whether democracy, ours, is better. So I don't see right now, anyway, any particular threat from China's nuclear weapons. As I said, they may have as many as 3 to 4, maybe as many as 500. They still enjoy a policy of decoupling their warheads from their missiles so that it will take, you know, a few hours, maybe as long as a day, for them to be able to launch their nuclear weapons. And as I said, ours are ready to launch now, this minute, and can be launched in a matter of minutes. So I guess I don't see the threat from the nuclear weapons side of things. And yes, the Chinese have been modernizing. Sometimes you want them to modernize so that things won't go off by accident. And certainly the United States has been modernizing its weapons for some time, actually starting in the Clinton administration, but even with more since the New START Treaty in 1991 and 2, we've been doing even more. And we're on, you know, on a path of replacing plutonium pits in some of the nuclear weapons, of really modernizing and making sure that our weapons are ready to go. So we are putting a lot of money into ours, and China may be modernizing. So is Russia. I mean, some people suggest that we are in a kind of slow burn arms race right now. And we're all part of it, not just China.
Well, with that rosy picture, Professor, I kind of want to ask about actual infrastructure, because we're living in a world where hacking is a norm, particularly by state actors, but also non-state actors. And so I guess this calls into question the security of our nuclear infrastructure. Can nuclear weapons be hacked, or the systems that deploy them be hacked? And I guess with that, how do we protect ourselves? How does the United States ensure that our weapons are not taken over by a malign actor?
That is the question of the day, isn't it? I've understood that our command and control system, which is really what you'd be hacking into, the ability to launch these weapons, there are as many as 1 million attempts a day to hack into the U.S. command and control system. It's a pretty dangerous situation. And I think many people have been worried about the that command and control system, and have been pretty good at defending against it. As you probably understand, any defense against a cyber attack really is an offensive game. You need to take out essentially the cyber attacker. You need to disable their capability in order to preserve your own safety. So, yeah, I think that's one of the big issues of the day. And some people are beginning to pay much more attention to it. But the U.S. is woefully behind in addressing the problem. The National Academies of Science in the early 2000s came out with studies to look at what the future of cyberspace would be. And even 20 years ago, we're recommending to the U.S. government that it pay attention to the problems of cyber attacks, not only on our military, but also in the private sector. What happens, as we all know now, what happens if there's a cyber attack on a dam or on a nuclear facility? The kind of havoc or the grid. We saw what happened in Texas, you know, without a cyber attack. But what if this were a malign attempt to take down our electrical grid? So, yes, it is a problem. We don't know outside of the classified material what really is going on. But I think it's clear that many people are now understanding what a threat this is. And again, it's coupled with this idea of a high launch readiness. And I keep coming back to this because there really is no need to have our weapons so ready to go. There just is no need for that. And if there ever was, and certainly not now, and what we're doing is really putting ourselves in the path of much more danger, either through blundering into a war, through a cyber attack, through some kind of accidental launch, just from human error, from the people who are down in those silos watching over the weapons. So, yes, there are ways that we could begin to counter the dangers of cyber attacks. And one simple way, certainly, would be just to take our weapons off of high launch readiness. So they're not ready to fly out. Each launch, you know, is 50 missiles in one launch. When you turn a key, 50 ICBMs travel across the Atlantic and then to China as well, and with just enormous destructive power, unimaginable.
So you did mention, you know, the possibility of blundering into a nuclear war or like an accidental launch due to like high launch readiness that our nuclear arsenal has. So in your view, I guess, what do you think is the likeliest cause of a potential nuclear war? Do you actually think it could be like an accidental war versus a very purposeful war? And do you think that this would likely be between like states or between states and non-state actors?
I guess I've been reading lately about NATO exercises up in the Barents Sea near Russia's borders. And I've been, and many other people have been thinking about, you know, what kinds of miscommunication could take place when we're flying so close to Russian borders, when the Russians are flying close to us, especially in the Arctic, where there seems to be this kind of simmering competition, shall we say, for who's going to rule in the Arctic, especially as climate change makes it more navigable and the possibility for oil drilling becomes much easier. So I guess there is the possibility, certainly, of some kind of accidental run-in, shall we say, between fighter pilots or bombers in those parts of the world. There have also been some accounts in North Korea also of U.S. planes in these exercises that we do with the South Koreans, that the North Koreans may get jumpy, may misunderstand some exercises that are going on and decide that, in fact, South Korea and the United States are about to invade and take over North Korea. And depending on the level of tensions, that could be, you know, a relatively plausible scenario. Jeffrey Lewis has written a great book, which is a fictional account of what happened, what might happen and how that might happen. It involves the accidental shooting down of a passenger airline, which, of course, has happened in the past. And then a miscommunication between South Korea and the United States and the South Koreans essentially launching an attack without the United States really knowing what was going on, and it follows from there. So, yes, it's very possible that we could have a kind of blunder. We've had misperceptions in the past at fraught times with the Soviet Union, especially during the Reagan era, when the Russians mistook a war games of called Able Archer for a full-on attack because the tensions were pretty high, and they went to their highest level of alert during that time. We were doing a war game. They thought it might be an attack. And Reagan's rhetoric was such that they felt that was plausible. So there are often tensions between states, and when you have weapons and exercises going on at a fairly consistent level, and there are human beings involved, and we know there is something called human error and miscommunication, there's always the possibility that we could actually end up in a nuclear exchange, hopefully one that can be stopped fairly quickly, but that's not entirely clear. Ukraine, of course, is another place where the U.S. and Russia are at odds, and that also involves third country Ukrainians who clearly are very interested in preserving their borders against the Russians. And so any place in the world where you have that kind of tension, you can begin to see that there might be the possibility of a nuclear exchange. And you've probably heard about the Russian policy of escalate to de-escalate, where if they feel threatened by a conventional attack, that they may use so-called tactical nuclear weapons, small nuclear weapons, to frighten, essentially frighten the United States into stopping its aggression. But the war plans that the U.S. has suggest that if nuclear weapons are used, the military would be quite able and willing and perhaps even eager to use our nuclear weapons in such an incident. So it's those, I think, and because, quote, small nuclear weapons, what does that mean? Small nuclear weapons are usually somewhere around the Hiroshima or Nagasaki nuclear weapon, which, as we know, can devastate a city instantly. So it's not clear that we would back off if that were the case. If somehow Kiev was damaged irreparably, it's not clear how much discipline the United States would have to stand down and not to attack in turn. So yes, I think the possibilities are quite, there are a number of them, and so that's why it's so important to think about how we reduce the launch readiness and reduce the number of nuclear weapons that we have.
I'm glad that you mentioned Russia's policy of escalate to de-escalate. Now I'm curious, from the United States perspective, what does our nuclear policy look like? What is our actual doctrine that the U.S. military has constructed? I think it's important just so that we understand like the comparative doctrines that each of these countries has.
Well, we know the most about the United States because there is a periodic nuclear posture review, as it's called, and the Trump administration issued its nuclear posture review in 2018. And in that review, they made it quite clear that nuclear weapons were not only to be used for deterrence, although many of us believe that that's the only posture we have. In fact, the United States is ready to use nuclear weapons really in many different situations, wherever we feel that our national security interests are at stake. So, for instance, if there were a cyber attack against the United States, we now say that we are willing to use nuclear weapons in retaliation. If there's a chemical weapons attack, we say that we could use nuclear weapons in that case. So in effect, under the last administration, we were saying that we're willing to use nuclear weapons in just about any time that our national interests seem to be threatened. That seems to many people to be beyond what we used to think of as nuclear deterrence. That is, that deterrence would be used that our nuclear forces would be used to deter a nuclear attack. Right now, and perhaps this posture will change under this administration, but right now the military is ready to use them in many situations where we feel our interests are threatened.
So when we talk about nuclear weapons, I always sort of think of a city being destroyed and a mushroom cloud rising amongst the ashes. And I mean, this might be a dumb question, but are all nuclear bombs destructive to that scale? Should governments ever be worried about, say, a suitcase nuke?
Well, a suitcase nuclear weapon could actually have the destructive power of a Hiroshima or Nagasaki sized bomb. It doesn't take a lot of plutonium, I mean, or to make a nuclear bomb, nuclear weapon. It takes a few other things, the mechanics of it and some of the chemical explosives. But it, in fact, the United States did have in its arsenal these suicide, what I call suicide, backpack nuclear weapons that they created in the 1950s, meant to be put on the back of a soldier who would walk into a military battle and use these against an enemy. So we did. We don't have those anymore, but it certainly is possible to make them. And the destructive power might not be quite as much as a Nagasaki or a Hiroshima bomb, but it would be substantial enough. And I think if we're talking about terrorists coming into the middle of Manhattan, which is always the classic example because it's such a densely populated part of our country, that kind of bomb would destroy Manhattan and kill, 200,000 people. So that's about the smallest we have, and that is pretty big. And if you think that that's that small, and the most of the weapons that we have and the Russians have are more like 300 kiloton yield rather than 20 kiloton yield, you can see that these bombs are meant to destroy not only a city, but all of the surrounding area. And if you've ever looked at Alex Wellerstein's nuke map, he can tell you how many casualties there'll be. For instance, if a bomb were dropped on bomb that the Russians might have, a typical one would drop on Chicago, for instance, where I live, and something like 300,000 people would be killed in one bomb, and with one bombing, and another 200,000 to 300,000 from the fallout. I mean, that the radiation sickness and the devastation from that. The mushroom cloud, that's right. The other thing is that, in fact, with our current war plan, the United States, and I think we understand that the Russians as well, use more than one bomb on each target. So at one point, the United States had something like 40 nuclear weapons targeted on Moscow. 40. I mean, it just kind of, it's unimaginable. So it's, in terms of our arsenals and what the war plans are, at least on our side, and we think pretty much they're echoed on the Russian side, we're talking about several bombs on major cities, not just one. So there really isn't much chance. You really can't hide from one of these.
Well, now we know that just the scale of the threat and how real and present that it is. And so I guess the natural question is, what's to be done? We know that there are options. We have nonproliferation, we have arms control, we have denuclearization. And so I guess with all of these options, I'm curious, how realistic is it for any substantial denuclearization, given deterrence theory, given mutually assured destruction? And with that, the question of compliance. How do we know that the Russians or the Chinese or the Iranians, when they develop such a capacity, or the North Koreans, that they're actually complying?
Big questions. Yeah, that is. I think that is the future, and we need to be thinking pretty hard about how to do all that. We've had pretty good success, with treaties and with mutual reductions, especially between the United States and the Soviet Union, now Russia. As I said, we went from 65 or so thousand down to 15,000. And the United States and Russia have engaged in mutual inspections now for some time. And the nuclear agreements between Russia and the United States in the New START treaty called for mutual inspections. I think over the years since 2011, when the treaty went into force, so over the course of 10 years or so, there have been something like 350 mutual inspections, where we go and look at their facilities, they come and look at ours. So there is really quite a bit of transparency based on these treaties. And so compliance is pretty strong, and neither side has cheated, at least on this treaty. There was on the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, there was some debate about who had violated the terms of that treaty. And of course, the United States then pulled out of the INF, and then as did the Russians. But I think when you do have agreement about what the measures are to be taken for compliance and for inspections, you know, they hold pretty well. We saw the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, which was an agreement, the so-called Iran deal between the United States and Russia, China, the European Union, and others with Iran, and the International Atomic Energy Agency, which is our international inspector, really, as well as providing technical assistance on civilian nuclear power. They were able to get into Iran's facilities, put in pretty sophisticated and new measures that were able to monitor those facilities 24/7, and the Iranians were in compliance with that agreement. They also allowed inspectors in when they needed to go into the facilities. So these are, you know, if you negotiate in good faith and you have the right inspection regime, it can happen. Now, the bigger question, of course, is can we get to even fewer numbers of nuclear weapons in the world? And the treaty that was just ratified in January to prohibit nuclear weapons was a step in the direction of trying to say what international law says, which is these nuclear weapons are really are not lawful weapons. They are weapons of genocide. They are weapons of mass slaughter. There's no way that you can pinpoint a nuclear bomb and just take out military facilities without harming civilians. And we have laws against killing civilians. Anytime there is are genocidal acts around the country, around the world, the U.S. gets very agitated about that. But when it comes to nuclear weapons, which cause mass slaughter, we don't seem to get too upset. Well, this treaty is an attempt to remind us that these nuclear weapons are, in fact, weapons of mass killing and should not be legitimate weapons of war. And that's the real impact of that, is to delegitimize nuclear weapons, to take them out of anyone's calculation about how to win a war. No one wins a war, as Reagan and Gorbachev said. The nuclear war cannot be won and should not be fought because every side loses. So how we get there, of course, is the big question. And right now, I think many people feel discouraged about it. But I think the fact that we really have only nine countries in the world with nuclear weapons out of, 190 or so countries in the world, that many countries have given up their nuclear weapons programs, There are nuclear weapons-free zones. The Treaty of Tlatelolco is one of the oldest and strongest in Latin America. And Argentina and Brazil certainly could actually be nuclear weapon states right now, but decided not to. So I think there are examples around the world where people have decided that these certainly are not worth it. And so I am hopeful that sometime, someday, we'll begin to understand these weapons as the weapons of slaughter that they are, and begin to understand that for our civilizations to continue, we need to get rid of them, reduce them, make them far less important than they are.
And on that note, Dr. Benedict, thank you so much for joining us today. This conversation was very educational and very informative on the real risks and the threats around nuclear weapons, a topic we don't hear too much about these days in our contemporary politics, but a topic we all certainly need to be very mindful of. So thank you, Dr. Benedict, for sharing your insights.
Thank you for having me. It was a real pleasure to be with you today.